Hi, my name is Astrid Alanguzian. I'm a husband and father of two. I'm also a rector of St. David's Anglican Church in Burbank, California. I love Jesus, and I love Jesus' people and the world, and I live for the sake of the world. This is the Cultural Christ.
Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, J.W. Buck. In this podcast, we explore the intersection between the Christian faith and cultural identity. We hold interviews with followers of Jesus to discuss the way our faith impacts our culture and how our cultural identity impacts faith. Now to this week's episode. Welcome, everyone, to this week's episode of The Cultural Christ. I am with a good friend of mine, Aster. How are you doing today, bro?
Doing well. Doing good here in sunny California, at least for today.
Good. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself, upbringing, cultural background, what you do for a living, family, all the things.
So I'm Armenian, an Armenian born in Lagos, Nigeria. I grew up here, though, in the States, and was a baptized Catholic and grew up in the Catholic Church, although most Armenians are part of the Apostolic Orthodox Church. We just so happened to be one of a small group of Armenians that were Catholic, Eastern Rite. So I grew up in L.A. for most of my life. Had a few years outside of L.A., lived in Jersey for a little bit. But this is really home. And in particular, since L.A. is huge, I've lived in Glendale most of that time, which is kind of like an enclave of Armenians. This is kind of the diaspora, the largest group of Armenians collected in one location outside of Armenia proper. Would be Glendale. So this is home, and that's actually where I am right now. I'm married to a beautiful wife, and we have two amazing boys, and 8 and 4. I guess something that is worth mentioning, I came to more of a confessing faith than traditionally being in the church at the age of 21. So that was about 20 years ago. That was a pretty important moment in my life. And at that moment, when I surrendered to Jesus, he called me into ministry. And so ever since then, I've been pursuing ministry, a life of a pastor. And it's been one exciting journey after another ever since. I got to meet you in that journey. And we've been friends for, I think, a little over 10 years, four, maybe a dozen years, 12, 13 years. And so now I'm a rector, which is like a lead pastor in an Anglican church. Here in, not in Glendale, but in Burbank, California, which is just west of Glendale, and to a nice little parish that's been around since 1931. And so, but I've been a church planter within that journey, and that led me to this particular church during COVID as we kind of merged as two churches. The only thing I'd like to say then, in addition to that, is I grew up having a relationship with the church, but not necessarily with Christ.
Yeah.
When I was a child and in my young adolescence. And then when I had that moment, my Damascus Road, like St. Paul, then I had this conversion experience.
Yeah.
And I had a relationship with Christ, but not necessarily the church. And so for me, the Anglican church was when those two worlds collided or came together, it really merged with my story because it's very Christ-focused. Kind of that evangelical spirit, but also Catholic in the sense of kind of the universal church as a whole. And so it's like a marriage of both. And that's where I am today.
Thanks for sharing. Let's go back a bit. You said you were born and you grew up for some of your youth in Nigeria, correct?
Till I was 4, actually. Only 4.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
And you came to Glendale when you were 4 or 5 years old.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Okay, so there weren't a whole lot of formative experiences in Nigeria, although certainly for your family. How does your family reflect back on being from Nigeria?
Oh, it was a positive time, but what led to my parents are from Lebanon, Beirut, so Beirut, Lebanon. And the reason they grew up there is because their grandparents survived the Armenian genocide, and so they had to flee. Okay. I don't know if folks on the podcast here are familiar with the Armenian genocide that took place in 1915 to 1919. where it was actually the word genocide was coined to discuss what happened to the Armenian people in those 4 years. It was an ethnic cleansing, and it was called the Great Crime of the 20th Century because nobody knew about it. And Hitler actually is known in one of his open air talks as saying something to the effect, "Who remembers the Armenians?" And that was in 1933, inferring that, hey, they got the Ottoman Empire got away with it, and it kind of gave a little bit of justification or a catalyst to his the Third Reich and all that kind of stuff. So my great-grandparents escaped, survived, and they settled in Lebanon, which a lot of Armenians, whoever did survive, the 30%, the only 30% that did during the time, 70% were massacred, migrated to different parts of the world, and basically adopted and assimilated in different cultures. So my great-grandparents went to Lebanon, and that's where my parents were born. But then there was a civil war in the 70s, and so they escaped and went to Nigeria. That's where, you know, my parents went there because my father started working with an American company. But then when I was four, there was going to be another civil war because there was a lot of corruption going on. So I was like, okay, pack up our stuff and let's move west again. So it was like from Armenia to Lebanon, from Lebanon to Nigeria, from Nigeria to the States. And so far, you know, it looks like we're good, but but you never know. We might have to pick up our stuff and keep going west. First stop would be Hawaii. But so that's kind of the thing, just because of the atrocities or the wars and that kind of thing led us to move. That's kind of my history as far as family does. But it was good up until my parents, as they reflect about their time in Nigeria, it was a good time. My sister was born, and I have two siblings. My brother was born in Lebanon. My sister was born in Nigeria a year before me. And then, so it was a positive time until right at the end.
So let's talk a little bit about Glendale. And the story where we met, I have to mention, it was super funny. I was doing therapy with a adolescent boy who is on the spectrum. And it was right before I picked him up at a local high school. And I walk into a Starbucks to get something. And there's this guy with all this theology books around him reading. And it was Astor, of course. And so we met, we struck up a conversation and really developed a friendship over ministry, Jesus, family, all the things. And while doing therapy in Glendale, I felt like I was in a completely unique subculture, even to LA, where I was church planting at the time. And I was like, this is its own thing.
Right.
And what I didn't know really at that point was so much of it had to do with the Armenian community and the different Armenian folks that came from, like you said, different parts of the world, whether I was meeting Iranian Armenian folks or Lebanese or just from Armenia and the different subcultures within those, and just receiving the hospitality of you, your family, this teenager I was taking care of, like I was in his house every day, having pastries and coffee and different layers of hospitality, like from the mom. And then when his dad came home from him and just learning so much, talk to me a little bit about your culture. And I'm not asking you to represent the culture of all your people, but like for you, what does it mean to be Armenian? You know what I'm saying? Help us understand.
Well, let me first say I've only experienced love at first sight twice in my life. One was when I met my wife, and the second one was when you walked through those doors at Starbucks. So, yeah, man, as far as the Armenian culture, my experience and my, like my wife, she's Armenian, but she's from Iran, like what you just mentioned. Mm. And so she grew up in a Persian culture in addition to her Armenian upbringing. And so, but across the board, whether you're from Lebanon, you're an Armenian from Lebanon or Iran or Armenia or Russia or Greece or Paris or whatever, we love family. We're very communal based. We love having gatherings and get-togethers, events where we come together, we break bread, we listen to music, and we dance, and we love to eat. And so whenever we can have an excuse for a big party, we never hesitate. And so we just love communal gatherings, you know, just gatherings, and blessing our neighbors, introducing our Armenian culture to them. I think a lot of Armenians take pride in that. We want the world to know who we are because we are kind of like the minority of minorities. There might be in the world 9 million Armenians. But by this point, you know, with social media and some celebrities, people are familiar with the Armenian community, but on a local level, different parts of the world, that might not be the case. And so with our neighbors and stuff, we want to, you know, invite them over, like the pastries you were talking about, having coffee and talking about the past and that kind of thing. So a very endearing community, I think, very kind, hospitable. But we've had, because of the unfortunate reality of our past, our history, the trauma, you know, on a social level, it's been in our psyche since 1915, this black cloud hovering over us, because for up until recently, most people didn't know about it. And then it wasn't recognized by the perpetrators themselves and still is denied. And so it's been hard for our Armenians to trust the other, whoever the other is, because just geographically where Armenia is on the map, the neighboring countries have, even before the genocide in 1915, going back to like the 13th century, so about 600 years being oppressed, having our women raped and our children massacred, you know, at different moments, not to the extent of 1915 where 1.5 million Armenians were massacred, but you did have these moments. And so we've been kind of on an island on our own. So we haven't had too many allies because there hasn't been a benefit, you know, strategically, geopolitically, or what have you. So because of centuries of that being kind of ingrained in our DNA, if you will, it's been hard to trust the other, whoever the other is. And so what you'll find in Glendale or different parts of the world where Armenians, like I said, like there'll be enclaves, communities like Little Italy or, you know, what have you in different parts. You'll have Armenians who commerce together, who kind of most of the time intermarry. And but that's changing as we've assimilated. We're like second, third generations Armenians now here in the States and across the world. That's not as much of a case anymore, but just sticking to each other, trusting each other, supporting each other, and, you know, kind of being at hand's length from others because we're suspicious. And you can understand kind of, at least like first generation Armenians, some of the older folks, some of those old heads, if you will, you know, that's all they experienced. It was, we were always, you know, we had to look out just to survive. We could only rely on another Armenian, not folks from other backgrounds and stuff.
Thanks for sharing that. And it really has been a big window into a people with an unrecognized history and culture, at least certainly in the States. And that's something I've learned from a lot of the Armenian friends that I've had, and how unrecognized for different geopolitical reasons. Like you said, just, well, what benefit is it if we're trying to be allies with Turkey right now or trying to be allies with these other countries to acknowledge what has happened and what that does? So I appreciate that. And it's something, honestly, Astor, I haven't had to think much about until I directly interacted with your people, because the history that has been written about North America broadly has been written by my descendants, the people who took over and settled,
right,
and just get to write the history and don't think twice about it. The things that are true and completely wrong about that history, the victors write the history. It's that simple.
Right.
And interacting with the Jewish narrative and the scriptures of a minority people who have largely been oppressed, and then your people have been such a window and a gift to me. Let's transition to Jesus. I want to talk about what were some of your first mental images of Jesus? Were there icons you were looking at? Was it, you know, the typical white evangelical version of that is usually like a you know, felt board Jesus during Sunday school or something, or there's a very famous white painting of Jesus. But what was your imaginary growing up? Maybe you talked about being more Catholic, but you're mixed in with tons of Orthodox folks that I'm sure overlapping with your family. Mm-hmm. Who was Jesus to you growing up?
Well, Jesus was, there was always a sacredness. I was introduced to Jesus in a church, obviously, as a good Catholic family. We went to church every Sunday, and it was a crucifix. So the mental image I have of Jesus is one of with suffering, because Jesus was still hanging on the cross. Different than, let's say, a Protestant cross, where Jesus is resurrected, victory, you know, triumph.
He's not there.
Right, he's not there. And so they're celebrating Sunday, where the Catholic Church is, they celebrate Sunday, but we don't want to forget about Friday. And just kind of a deep theology of the cross and suffering. I mean, at that age, you're not considering all that stuff. But my mental image was, here's a man who is suffering, and you see blood, you know, on his palms and on his side and the crown. And so there was a sense of love. There was a sacredness at church. In relation to Jesus, he was sacred. He wasn't just like anyone. But in addition to that, there was also, Jesus was connected to a group. Because I met Jesus in a church. It wasn't just someone that, was a one-off or what have you. So it was always in the context of a church, in a community, and we came. And we just have to stand and sit and kneel and sing songs to him. And it was very, there was a somber, but more, there was like solemnity. There was a sense of like, this is heavy. This is meaningful. It wasn't like, there wasn't a lot of joy or excitement. It was very sober. I think the incense and things like that contributed to that, the icons and the candles and all those kinds of things. So there was a lot of reverence towards given to Jesus. So mentally it was always like, you honor Jesus. As far as like the white Jesus, I mean, as a kid, I watched King of Kings. That had a, when you're 5, 6, 7, 8, it was like, okay, it was an introduction to Jesus. I couldn't tell the difference at the time. But yeah. He had that blue eyes and that the wind blowing in his hair. And he was a peaceful person. It wasn't until later that I kind of figure out, I think through others and stuff, that, whoa, maybe this isn't the most accurate representation of Jesus. It's being communicated to a particular, context and lens and that kind of thing. So, but Jesus has always been kind of, at that point, he was heroic and he was gentle, but he suffered. And so suffering's always been part of my, I guess maybe I was predisposed to that image of Jesus, of a suffering Messiah.
And as you journeyed further, you talk about a confessional faith or conversion, however we want to phrase it, really deciding to have a relationship with Jesus. And then for those who don't know, Astor has tons of theological training, super smart. Like, how has that journey also informed your understanding of who Jesus is in relationship to, did it really like circle back and affirm the Jesus that you knew growing up? Has it changed your understanding of Jesus?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I appreciate those kind words, but I want to say, of course, it's broad and I've had to unlearn some things and learn new things. Because, the whole point of going to seminary is not just to kind of reaffirm what you already know, but to extend your horizons and understanding. Or what's the point, right? Just keep going to church on Sunday and just parrot back everything that you've heard. But you want to be challenged, I think. That's part of the whole higher education, I think. That's part and parcel, part of the educational experience. But yeah, because there wasn't a real, and I know it's cliche, it's maybe something that's been said since like the 90s or something. But, I didn't have a relationship with Jesus. I had a relationship with the church because he was all, like I said, and I love mass. As a kid, I really enjoyed it until I had a bad experience with a nun, but we'll leave that for another day. But I thank God for that upbringing. But in any event, with that upbringing, there were limitations and shortcomings. And one was actually knowing that I could actually personally walk with Jesus, that he's walking with me. And so having a more personal relationship, if you will, I mean, there's no other way of describing it but that. And then my conversion introduced that, wow, I can actually talk to Jesus and he talks back to me and he's with me. And it was so more intimate. And it wasn't so, I don't want to say cold, but there wasn't a distance in my evangelical conversion experience. And so that I'm very grateful for, because now I knew he knew me and that he was with me, not only in this one space called a church building, but that he was with me everywhere. And then that now that I was called to follow him, to deny yourself, pick up your cross and follow it. Well, where is he going? And so that's the journey of looking very, very closely at where he's taking us as a people. So to follow him. So now it's like, wow, I actually have to apply him in my life, in various areas in life, and that wasn't the case when I was a kid or even until I was like a teenager in my limited Roman Catholic experience.
Yeah. And I mean, I've personally seen that in your church planting journey. Parts of being a church planter in Glendale is it's countercultural as an Armenian to be forging new space and doing that. And so seeing that take place ahead of Emerge with your current church is pretty beautiful. Let's talk about the interplay between being Armenian and following Jesus. So what aspects of your cultural identity and the story of your people do you see Jesus in the scriptures really affirming and dignifying? And maybe what other parts do you see Jesus challenging and subverting or trying to shape in a new direction?
So Armenians take pride in being the first nation to accept Christianity as the official religion in 301. And it's kind of in the footnotes in history books. But again, kind of what you said earlier, it depends on who's writing history and how many people are informed about things like that. And so Armenians have been Christians for 1700 years. We take a lot of pride in that. And so to be Armenian is synonymous as being Christian. But for all intensive purposes, what does that mean? Like, how does it translate? It's very nominal, though. It's cultural. Do many Armenians attend church and revere and believe in having a religious life? Is it part of our orientation or our makeup as a community? Yes. Clearly something we value, right? Religiosity and that sort of thing. When it comes to the teachings of Jesus, you know, on the Sermon of the Mount, you know, being meek and peacemaker and what have you, right? That doesn't necessarily translate, or it doesn't meet us. And when it comes to practicing as being like an apprentice of Jesus, a disciple of Jesus, those aren't really things that we, again, like I said, we went to church on Sundays. I think it's the same in the Orthodox Church, in the Armenian Orthodox Church. It's a place where you go and you are fed, if you will, but then you leave everything there for the most part. I'm not speaking about everybody, just generally speaking, broad brush, right. But just generally speaking. But then, you know, when you leave, you know, in your household, in your community, you know, in your workplace, in your school, you know, are you sharing the aims of Jesus? Are you living in the aims? Are you promulgating? Are you living for Jesus? Are you embodying Jesus? Are you demonstrating Jesus? That's not necessarily the case, I think. And I'll take some maybe criticism for saying that, but I'm just being honest. Instead of like Jesus being just like a stoic, historical, archaic figure, I think that's the challenge of making him really the center of your life and your purpose on earth, and his words being like the air you breathe, and walking with Jesus for the sake of the world. So there is a disconnect, I think, unfortunately. And that could be because of potentially, I just think, catechism. That's my two cents, like teaching the people more than just like liturgy and ritual and those kinds of things. There's a place for that, but then to teach, why do we do and say these things, and having Bible study and educating our people, I think that's across the board, just like Armenians in churches. I think even in North America, the church being catechized in the sense of learning what it means to follow Jesus and not head stuff. I'm just talking about real practical, you know, praxis stuff where you're actually applying his wisdom and his teachings in our lives. So I think that's across the board. Many of us share that, but I think in our community, that's one of the challenges. And so, like I said, holding grudges, forgiving, being resentful, bitter, and then breaking, you know, maybe doing things that are not the law of the land. I don't know, just like any community. I think having that conviction of being a good steward of your time, talents, treasures, whatever.
That's wonderful. So if I can summarize really quickly, one way that Jesus really challenges your people is to let go of cultural Christianity, to let go of a Christianity that demands some time and reverence, maybe one day a week, but to really be shaped and changed by the faith and to live for Jesus, like you said, the center of your life. I definitely resonate with that. And I'm not trying to draw connections that don't exist, but having been born in Texas and spent a lot of time in different parts of the South, there's certainly less history attached to it. And I have to acknowledge that, right? We're not going back to 300 years after Jesus and Christianizing a people and a nation, but there's certainly cultural Christianity that runs deep in the South. And it's so tricky because it's infused into the language that's used during the week and the prayers that people pray at meals. And so how do you decipher that and separate that from authentic faith when it's so infused into, well, of course we don't do this on Sunday because it's the Sabbath, or of course we pray every day, or we have these different religious liturgies or habits, but is it a transformed life? It gets tricky distinguishing the two. What about dignifying and really affirming your cultural identity? Where do you see Jesus come alongside your people and dignify the expressions and the culture that you have?
I think, you know, honoring your father and mother, family, community, a sense of living for a purpose beyond yourself as an individual, which is a very Western ideology that we've inherited and being shaped. You use the word shape I think culturally in the West, as Armenians have now, you know, moved West, that's been one of the challenges. I think that goes against the grain of who we are as a people. But how Jesus culturally, if you will, has still had an impact, because 1700 years is nothing to make light of. He has had, because, I mean, up until, here's the thing, up until the genocide, you know, most Armenians, you know, I think they were practicing their faith. I think Jesus was a transformative person in their lives, right? Mm-hmm. In loving your neighbor, loving your enemy, turning the other cheek, feeding those who are hungry, the widows, bringing them into your home, nourishing them, loving on them. I believe so. You had that. But then what happened is, and I'll answer your question more directly in a second, it's just that I think once the genocide took place, Armenians were like, where's God? Like, I imagine if you're a Jewish person during Auschwitz, Germany,
yeah,
and you're like, how could you not ask that question? Where are you, God? How could you let this happen? Right? So I think there was a crisis of faith. How could it not, as a human being, when you're seeing 70% of your population, women and children, being massacred, killed, starved in the desert, and then being raped in front of their husbands, and just very atrocious things, right? So then you had 100 years of communism after the genocide, right? That just followed. 100 years of a kind of an atheism that was kind of the law of the land. And so you can understand by 2020, in the 21st century, two generations have experienced, you know, these huge cataclysmic events. One, the genocide, and then a communism that made it illegal to practice, you know, your faith. And so it became very secular, if you will, in that sense. And more nominal Christianity than anything. They kind of allowed you to some degree, but very limited to the scope and the manner and that kind of thing. So you can understand why, I can understand why in my experience today, in my community, as I exegete, and I'm just being honest and critical, and part of my upbringing was no different. I'm no different, you know, part of the whole. Yeah. And so it's not like I'm just looking at my neighbor. This is kind of the aftermath and the reality of it. But despite all that, I think despite all of those challenges, I still think 1700 years of a particular belief system shaped our community in the point where we still value community. We think about, we're about honor and shame. And so the thing we consider, what will my actions do? How will it represent my family, honoring my mother and father, but also your body? I think we, as Armenians, we value the body. It is a sacred temple. And so what do I mean by that? You're not going to find much of pornography, for example, in the Armenian community, because the way that we value this body that we've given, I think that's more of a Western thing, where there's a lot of freedom, independence, and kind of like your body's a canvas and you can do whatever you want with it. And I have no problems with like tattoos or earrings or anything like that. I'm just giving you, these are things like maybe were taboo 15, 20, 30, 40 years ago in the church or what have you. Whether you're in the church or not in the Armenian community, it's just one of these things where there's a sense of like, how do you represent your family with your body? This sacred, precious gift you've been given, that's who you are. And you don't separate your body from other things in life. Now, somebody can push back on that in the Armenian community. Again, maybe second, third generation, but historically. So I think, what do you do with your body? How do you use it? How do you express your creativity or whatever? I think the body plays a huge role. And I think that maybe goes counter to maybe Western practices or views. I can even see that in Eastern religions equally share the same sort of perspective that we might as a community.
Yeah. And so that Jesus is close to those values. And Jesus, as a ancient Near Eastern rabbi, son of God, the cultural values overlap really closely with those aspects of the Armenian community, including the marginalization and the suffering of a people who aren't writing history. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah, I think, look, the story of Exodus, of being freed under Egypt and Pharaoh and being in the wilderness and being, you know, going against the oppressor, being freed and liberated from the oppressor, right? And so I think contextually, I think you'll hear that in Armenian in homilies in the church, where we can identify. And I know that happens in the Black church too. You can, it's very prophetic in that sense. And in the same, so you contextualize, you know, we're no different, right, from the empire or what have you, whoever's in power at the time. And so Armenians have found that narrative very part of our story. There's a lot of parallels with the Jewish people, and just and other communities likewise, not just the Armenians, who've gone through oppression, tyrant, or what have you, or a group, or a community, you know, whatever it is. So yeah, I would just agree with what you just said. Yes.
Well, Astor, this has been awesome. I really appreciate your time. And so, you're still a Kobe fan, right? Kobe for life. You guys don't know that Astor is like a huge Kobe defender, Kobe fan. Obviously, he tragically passed a few years back, which was terrible. Mm-hmm. You still think of Kobe? You still watch clips of Kobe? You still watch LeBron and be like, he doesn't deserve these colors? Like, where are you at with your Kobe love?
Oh, of course. No doubt. Absolutely. Everything you said is gospel. So Kobe for life, since I was 13 until I was 20 years following, diehard Kobe Laker fan. And the name behind the jersey was just as important, if not more important sometimes, than the name in front of the jersey. So big diehard Kobe fan, love him. Not a big fan of LeBron. Again, it maybe it's the generation. I don't know his game. I'm big on aesthetics. I don't think it's poetic. I don't think he plays with the same grace, the dexterity of the body and stuff. So he's a good guy. I'm sure he's a wonderful human being, but when on the court, it's no match for me. Kobe, diehard Mamba for life.
Are you still a diehard Laker fan, or did Kobe kind of win you over? Or are you flirting with other teams out there?
I'm torn, you know, it's tough, especially with LeBron being on our team. It's just like, geez, my arch nemesis is now part of this team. So yeah, I still root for them. I just hope LeBron shoots like 3 for 50 or something every game with like 12 turnovers, as long as the Lakers win and his stats don't match up, you know. But I'll root for, you know, I like Anthony Edwards from Minnesota, actually. So he kind of reminds me of Kobe and MJ. So look out for Anthony Edwards. But yeah, I'm still there, unfortunately, or I don't know, however you want to just characterize it.
Well, Astor, thanks so much for being on. And it's great seeing you and having a discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, Josh. My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much for listening. If you want more content, you can go to jwbuck.org or follow me on Instagram, handles jwbuck. If you have any questions about culture, cultural identity, or faith, feel free to send me a message. Hope you'll join us next week.